You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
If you're an RIA, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at Schwabvious.com.
What's going on, everybody? I hope that you're having a great day. Welcome into episode 2 of the GDP podcast. I'm your host, Griffin Della Penna. For those of you that maybe haven't had a chance to yet, now's your time to go back and listen or watch episode 1 on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Amazon Music. So then you can get a pretty good lay of the land in what to expect in this series as I talk extensively and what I strive for this podcast to be. And then I also share my own personal journey, not just in the sports broadcasting realm, but some of the adversity that I've had both professionally and personally in my own life. And before we get into who our first ever guest is in the GDP podcast and how they've also played a role in my own life, I do want to circle back about episode 1 and just give a huge thank you to the amount of support that I received in sharing my own story in episode 1, because I'll be transparent, that was very difficult for me to do. Being in a vulnerable state, opening up about my own mental health and something that up to this point in my life, I've never really dealt with, thankfully. But as I was about to drop this episode, there was a lot of anxiety that surrounded it and negative voices that were kind of entering my brain of, will this be viewed in a negative connotation professionally that I open up about my own mental health as I try to navigate my way up the industry, or even in my personal life? I really, up to this point, have not been transparent or told a lot of people about my struggles over this past year, because I think I wasn't one ready to, probably didn't realize the situation that I was in and that I actually was struggling. And three, I think it's very easy to put on a persona on social media with all of the amazing and great things that have transpired for me over this past year. And I don't want this to sound like I've been in an immense struggle every single day, but it is something that I have dealt with over this past year. And I think that social media does create this, again, sort of warped perception that everything in my life was going great according to plan. I'm traveling a lot. I'm with my friends and family, all of the, again, amazing things that actually were transpiring. But there was a large part of my life that I was leaving out there. So I do think it was maybe an opportunity for even a lot of the people that are very, very close to me to maybe recognize that, wow, you know, this was a big part of Griff's life. And I think that is something that, regardless, if you're in a position like me and you have a podcast, or if you're just looking for help and want to talk to other people, I was very gracious to receive some messages from individuals who were going through similar things as me, and that they found it motivational or empowering enough to open up about some of those things regarding their own mental health and trying to talk to me about it, or now feeling motivated enough to talk to other people. And if I can do that, I guess I'm doing something right with this series. And I did mention it in episode 1, but I did find this pretty therapeutic for me to take a bird's eye view and recognize the power that I've had over this past year, and to be able to be on the other side of it and still grow in a lot of different ways. Even though I'm still not where I want to be, a year ago from right about now, I was in a much different scenario. So a lot to be grateful for there. Now moving into episode 2, I was thinking with this first guest, I need it to be a great episode. I need to show what I think that this series really can be. And I wanted it to be somebody who has helped me also on my journey. And there was one individual that really just stuck out for not just being there for me over this past year, being a great mentor of mine, but ever since the day that I got in contact with them at this point over 3 years ago. And that man is Sean McDonough, who people that are in the sports broadcasting realm, he is the best of the best, one of the most versatile play-by-play broadcasters of all time, not just currently with ESPN as the lead voice in their NHL coverage. Also, you can hear him on Saturdays for college football's coverage on ABC, specifically in the SEC. But he's basically done everything under the moon, going back to his time at CBS at 30 years old, calling World Series nationally televised games, doing very niche sports, the Olympics. He's really done it all. And we talk about in this episode how his journey from his dad being a legendary Boston Globe sports writer opened up this industry. And that's, again, what he's always wanted to do, was be in this space and not just being in baseball, which we talk about, and how he was a broadcaster for the Boston Red Sox at 25 years old, his favorite team growing up, but to be able to be very versatile and have all of these different sports in his repertoire. So it's a great interview. It's an amazing conversation with, again, not somebody that I just look up to professionally for what he's been able to do, but even more so on the person side, because Sean is incredibly genuine in every single interaction that he has. And that's what I also want to be known for. He says it as well, that if he doesn't treat everybody else away from the broadcast, the people on the crew, with love and compassion, then other people aren't going to want to work with you, right? Your work, your caliber, that is always number one. But the lasting impact that you have in this industry is how you make other people feel and how you treat them. So that is very important to me. I think everybody will love hearing this insight at somebody who has really seen it all so far in his career and certainly has a very amazing perspective and is incredibly grateful for all that he's been able to do. So without further ado, here's our first ever guest on the GDP podcast, Mr. Sean McDonough. Alrighty, everyone, we have our first guest here on the GDP podcast, and he is somebody who has been an incredible mentor of mine, somebody who's been very invested in my own personal career, and he's one of the most versatile play-by-play broadcasters that the industry has ever seen. We just talked before this, he is very involved in college football, in the NHL season coming up with ESPN, and also we're going to sprinkle in some postseason baseball as well. A good friend joins me here today, Sean McDonough. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm honored to be guest number one on this podcast, which I'm sure will be a huge success. So good to see you, my friend. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, before we kind of dive into the beginnings of your career and why you aspired to be a broadcaster, in the summertime, when you're not as crazy busy as you're about to be, do you ever have the time to reflect on what a wild ride your career has been?
Yeah, I don't spend as much time on it. You know, sometimes, Griffin, things will happen, and then you reflect. You know, like last football season, we had a chance to do the first college football playoff game ever on a college campus, and it was at Notre Dame, and at night on this beautiful winter night. It was just cold and clear, and it was perfect, you know. And as someone who grew up in South Boston in an Irish Catholic family and wanted to go to Notre Dame, you know, the chance to be there. And we were the first people, non-NBC people, to do a game there in like 30-something years, because NBC's had the rights for a long time now. So, you know, things like that just happen, and then it gets you reflecting, because I've been doing this for a long time, and obviously I'm closer to the end of it than the beginning, but there's still things that pop up. You know, a month later, we're doing the Four Nations Face-Off hockey tournament, which I thought would be awesome, but nobody had any idea how awesome that was going to be and how much it would catch on with the sporting public, not just hockey fans, but even non-hockey fans were tuned in. So I do take time. I try to smell the roses, as they say. You know, I do feel grateful every day that, you know, I get to do what I always wanted to do. And you just touched upon it in the introduction. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to announce all the sports. You know, I was a sports fan. My dad was a sports writer. I followed him around. So I didn't want to be just a baseball announcer or a football announcer. I wanted to do all the sports. And, you know, in a five-game span, you know, five-day span coming up here, I'm going to do baseball playoffs, a college football game, and then opening night of the NHL. So I'm still living my dream all these years later.
And you just mentioned your dad being a reporter for the Boston Globe and him being able to almost peel back that layer and give you an experience at such a young age. How influential was that as a six-year-old saying that, hey, I want to be a broadcaster for the Boston Red Sox and having that experience?
Yeah, it was totally...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Most important thing by far. You know, when I was a kid, you know, the seasons didn't overlap as much. So my dad covered all the teams, the Red Sox, the Patriots, particularly the Patriots, but the Celtics, the Bruins. And when we were really young, we'd go down to Winter Haven, Florida, where the Red Sox had spring training at the time. And, you know, we'd be homeschooled in the morning. Then we'd go over to the spring training park, the Red Sox Channel Lakes Park. And, you know, I remember Johnny Pesky, legendary Red Sox player and coach, and hitting me fungos and playing pepper with him. You know, I was 6 years old or whatever. But I remember mostly sitting in the back of the Red Sox radio booth and thinking, wow, this is really fun. You know, and they taught me how to keep score. And so I knew when I was 5 or 6 years old that that's what I wanted to do. And it was always on a path from that moment on. I had a little tape recorder, used to lie on the floor in the living room and call every game I could off the TV. Drive my family crazy. So, you know, to be sitting here talking to you now, quite a bit beyond 5 years old, to, you know, have had a chance to do just about everything I've ever wanted to do is really awesome. I'm just grateful to God more than anything else.
And your journey then led you to Syracuse and getting involved with WAER on the radio side, but you ended up working for the football team under head coach Dick McPherson. How pivotal was that also in your career journey, not just as a broadcaster, but like you said, your faith and life as a whole?
Yeah, it was big on all of those levels. You know, he was a devoutly Catholic person and probably the nicest person I've ever been around in terms of a public figure interacting with the public, you know, with the people of the Central New York community. You know, he was gracious and kind to everybody. And not, it wasn't fake. It was just who he was. He cared about everybody, and we should all care about everybody. So learned a lot from him, learned a lot about the football part too, which has helped me in my broadcasting career, calling college football. It gave me a great appreciation for how hard these coaches work and how much goes into it, emotional investment, and you know how hard the winning and losing is. Well, the winning is not that hard. The winning is awesome, but the losing is really hard. Especially in football, where you're only playing 12 games or 13 games. You know, back then, I think we were playing 11 games when I was working for Coach Mack, maybe 12 if you made it to a bowl game. So he was a great influence. And then, you know, my dad was a huge influence too. You know, just, you know, to work hard, be fair, be honest, treat people well, be prepared. You know, there's so many things that I learned from both of those guys. But more than anything, just how to, you know, live life the right way as much as you can. And we're all flawed, but try to do the right things as much as I can.
When you were still in school, you were able to get hands-on experience with the Syracuse Chiefs calling games right away. When you're able to now look back, what were some of the biggest lessons that you learned with that experience, being able to, again, still in school, being able to get reps with a minor league baseball team?
Yeah, that was an awesome experience. You know, we... the student radio station, WAER, that you mentioned, had the broadcast rights for the Syracuse Chiefs. They were the top farm team for the Toronto Blue Jays. So, you know, by the time I graduated, I did it for three seasons. You know, shortly after I graduated, I had done about 400 minor league baseball games. one level below the major leagues. So it was a huge head start, you know, to be 22 years old and have that on your resume. So I think without that, I wouldn't have been doing the Red Sox games when I was 25 years old. So yeah, well, that was a great experience. And it was also a great experience because, and you and I have had these conversations, you know, the most important thing, especially at the point in your life where you are, any young broadcaster, is getting experience, getting repetitions, getting on the air, developing your own style, your own comfort level, learning from your mistakes, having other people listen to your tapes and offer you critiques, you know, that sort of thing. So to have, you know, reps day after day after day after day, all summer long. And, you know, you learn, I was doing a lot of those games by myself. So, you know, you learn how to tell stories and prepare because, you know, you can't just show up and wing it. You know, you need to go down and talk to the players and find out how they're doing, who's injured or anything else. You know, his wife just had a baby today, whatever it is, you know, you want to fill the time and have it be interesting. So you have to prepare. So it was a great learning experience and probably the most important thing in the chronology to the other things I did after that I experienced.
And you continue with that progression, and this is why you're the best, because you lead me into my next question, being able to broadcast Red Sox games at such a young age. Just how did that come about? And then also when you get there at such a young age, what were the emotions with that? Was there doubt? Hey, am I ready for this at such a national stage? And again, so early in my career when this is all that I've ever wanted to do.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when I got out of Syracuse and did the third season of minor league baseball, I got a job that fall, in the fall of 1984, as a sideline reporter on the Ivy League football game of the week, which was on PBS. So it was a good gig to be the sideline reporter because there were no commercials on PBS. So you got on a lot, you know, the end of the quarter, or, you know, they score a touchdown and now there's the time where you have to go to the other end of the field and get ready for the kickoff. So they're constantly going to you. And there's so many great stories in the Ivy League because these guys are smart and they have interesting hobbies and they belong to supper clubs and all these interesting things. So that was a great experience. And I got hired by NESN, which is, as you know, the Red Sox and Bruins cable carrier. It was just starting. When I started there, they were in 3,000 homes. I mean, I used to do college soccer and college hockey and wonder, really, is there anybody watching? Like, I didn't know many, if any, people who had NESN. You know, my friends never said, hey, I saw you on that college soccer game the other day. So started out doing that. They had a relationship with Channel 38. Channel 38 in Boston, WSBK, owned part of NESN along with the Red Sox and the Bruins. So I started doing Red Sox pregame and postgame for NESN and Channel 38 for the Red Sox and Bruins. And then, when I was 25, the play-by-play, the same guys had done all the games on NESN and Channel 38, the Red Sox games, Ned Martin and Bob Montgomery. And Ned Martin was one of my idols. He was one of those guys in the broadcast booth in the late 1960s who I was watching thinking this would be cool. So Channel 38, NESN was going to keep Ned and have him work with Jerry Remy. And then Channel 38 was going to keep Bob Montgomery and hire a play-by-play person. So I was at the station. I had 400 games of minor league experience. The general manager of the station, Mr. Berkery, Dan Berkery, is like my second or third dad. I mean, we had a really close relationship, although he had enough of his own kids. He had 10 kids, so he didn't really need me to be number 11, but and 10 great kids, I might add. Not, you know, they all went to Harvard and Cornell and Boston College and Virginia and Georgetown. But anyway, it took a very long time. You know, there was a lot of speculation that I was kind of the leading contender. And then it was dragging on and dragging on. It was probably February and the season was, you know, spring training was about to start. And I got a call from Mr. Berkery's secretary, and she said, Mr. Berkery would like to meet you. You come to his house. So I thought, oh no, he doesn't want me to go to the station because he doesn't want to have me get upset in front of all my friends and fellow employees. So he wants to give me the bad news at his house. So I drove out to his house west of Boston. I'd been there before, so I kind of walked through the garage. I knew sort of the way they all go in the house. And Mrs. Berkery, Liz, was in the kitchen. And when I walked by through the kitchen, I'm going to choke up remembering this all these years later. She was standing in the kitchen and she looked at me and she went, like, two thumbs up. And I thought, oh, maybe this is going to go better than I thought. So they gave me the job. And, you know, obviously that was the thrill of a lifetime when I was that little kid at 5 years old. I wanted to do all the sports, but more than anything else, I wanted to be the voice of the Red Sox. So to have that chance when I was 25 was really awesome. And then I don't know if I'm leading into your next question, but you know, that led to like the ESPN people saw me on the Red Sox games because ESPN's in Bristol, Connecticut. That's Red Sox territory. When they'd come home, they'd watch the Red Sox games. So they saw me on there and called and offered me the opportunity to do, I think it was Wednesday night baseball when I first started for them. They were just starting out. CBS saw me on ESPN. They hired me to do the NCAA tournament. That's how I got in the door there in 1990. So I say all the time, a lot of times it just takes one opportunity. It leads to a bunch of other things. And that was certainly the case for me.
Yeah, it opened a lot of doors for you. And you spent then 17 seasons in some capacity with the Red Sox doing certain games. And while your career is starting to expand and you're with CBS and you're still making it very apparent that you want to be with the Red Sox and have that be the cornerstone of your career. But ahead of the 2005 season, you find out that your contract was not going to be picked up for that option in your deal. And there were much other lucrative offers where you could have went with other teams like the Mets, but you wanted to be in Boston. How challenging was that mentally, that time in your life when you have this relationship with a team that goes so much far beyond just being a broadcaster, but you've been around it your entire life to then know, hey, I'm not going to be.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Doing Red Sox games anymore.
Yeah, it was really challenging just because it was unexpected. You know, they had led my agent to believe, them being Nesson, that I had an option in my contract. I was going to be picked up. And then I got a random phone call. I was at the University of Michigan watching a basketball practice for a game I was doing there. And my phone rang with some reporter from the Boston Herald, who I didn't know, was calling to ask me about my contract not being renewed. And I said, well, that's not true. And he said, well, yes, it is. So that was a hard way to find out after 17 years. So, you know, I could kind of see it coming because for all the years, you know, I'd done the over-the-air TV, starting with WSBK, and then the games moved around. But Nesson always had their separate package on the cable. And then there were fewer and fewer games on over-the-air TV and more on Nesson. And to the point where I was just doing Friday night games, and WBZ Channel 4 in Boston, they were carrying the Friday night games, but they didn't want to hire all these people to do one game a week, so they contracted Nesson. So I knew once I started to get paid by Nesson, that was going to be a problem because they were sort of infamous and still are in our business for not paying people very well. So I knew they thought I was making more than they wanted to pay me. So ultimately, that's sort of what it was. But so it was really rough. As I said, you know, that was my childhood dream. And it came kind of at the end of, or in the midst of, a really tough stretch. I mean, my agent, Robert Fraley, was a wonderful guy and friend, died in the plane crash with Payne Stewart in 1999. I left CBS. That was surprising. I can't share that story, but that'll be in the book someday because there was a lot of circumstances that were not in my control, and it wasn't because of my performance, as I came to find out later, actually in real time. My dad died in 2003. So, you know, it's just kind of like, what now? This, you know, but, you know, talked about wanting to go to Notre Dame when I was a kid and not getting in, you know, and it was sort of then I realized for the first, not maybe the first, but for one of many times, to trust in God's plan, right? I wound up at Syracuse. It was the best place for me. It's the cradle of sports broadcasters. You know, I got those minor league baseball games. I met Coach McPherson. That was a valuable experience in so many ways, personally, and the football part of it. So I just accepted, okay, this is part of God's plan. And it was great. I had done it long enough. And it led to a whole bunch of other things. I remember a few years later being at the British Open, the Open Championship at St. Andrews, you know, the cradle of golf. As you know, I'm a passionate golfer. You know, I love it more than I should. So I remember sitting there looking out at the birthplace of golf in this beautiful town and this historic course. And I'm doing the British Open on national TV and thinking, if I was still with the Red Sox, I wouldn't be here right now. And there were a lot of experiences like that. So, yeah, it was hard. But with hindsight, you know, I think it was the best thing for me. You know, I never would have left on my own. And And now I'm back with them. You know, I think this is the seventh season I've done a handful of radio games for them. So it's been nice to remake that connection.
Yeah. Why was that the right time in 2019 to begin in, again, a limited capacity doing games with the Red Sox again?
Yeah, I guess because that was when they asked me. And when they first called me, you know, the great guy named Joe Zarbano, who was running the programming for WEEI, which is the flagship station, I knew of him, but I really didn't know him. And I was in Arizona in the winter where I live, and the phone rang, and he said, "Joe Zarbano, would you have any interest in doing Red Sox radio?" And I assumed, like, you want to come do 150 games? It's like, no, I can't. First of all, I couldn't, you know, with my ESPN commitments. But that's also the baseball day-to-day. If you're a team broadcaster, it's a grind. I mean, it is. You're doing 150, 160, 162 games, very few off days. So he said, "No, but you can just do a handful. You can pick which games you do." So I said, like, I could do 30 home games. I really don't want, I have my time off in the summer. I don't want to pack a suitcase and go into the airport. And they can be against the Yankees or, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers if they're on the interleague schedule. Yes, you can do that. And I said, that'd be an idiot to not accept that. And then, you know, I love baseball on the radio. And it's the Red Sox, right? It's what I wanted to do when I was a kid. And it's still special every time I go in there. So that's been a wonderful experience for these last 7 years. More wonderful this year because they're winning. So as we speak, they're winning. So it's been a lot of fun.
When CBS brought you in 1990, you were immediately put in a lot of different roles, doing college basketball and college football, NFL, PGA, the Winter Olympics. You can go on and on with all the sports that you did. How were you able to, regardless of your assignment, have that comfortability in yourself to know that you're putting forward the best product that you absolutely can and have that wide range of sports in your repertoire?
That's another great question. I think the most important thing, there are several important things. You know, the mechanics of play-by-play broadcasting don't change very much, right? It's the same thing. Who are the participants? Where are they from? How well do they do? You know, you're doing the Olympic luge. This is Georg Hockel. You know, he's the defending world champion. You know, there's, again, research, right? It's preparation. But, you know, I've done 11 sports on national TV, and I say to people, you know, play-by-play is transferable. You know, who's participating? Tell me something I don't know about them. Stay on top of the competition. You know, what's going on in the game? That's the most important thing, you know, in football or baseball, whatever, the score, the time remaining, the whatever. And then hopefully, you know, well-timed nugget or story, if it's appropriate, and, you know, interact with your analyst and the people in the truck. So it's but the preparation is most important. Anyway, when I got assigned the bobsled and luge in 1992, I didn't know anything about bobsled. I mean, I knew you got on a sled and or whatever, and you went as fast as you could down the hill, but that's all I knew. So I went up to Lake Placid. I met the, you know, U.S. luge team, the bobsled team, the people who coached them and run them, and I learned. They taught me, you know, here's how you luge. I actually did a luge run, which was insane with hindsight and almost the death of me. And, you know, so, but, you know, sometimes you have to go to that extreme to prepare.
You almost spent a decade there, and then you've been with ESPN ever since 2000 in a landscape where things are changing all the time. Broadcasters are picking up at one place for 3 years, going to somewhere else. What do you think it says about you and your quality of work and all of the other things that don't necessarily even have to do with broadcasting, the qualities that you have to be with a worldwide leader for this long?
Well, this is going to be a little, I don't know what the right word is, self-indulgent, and I hate to be that way, but I think the most important thing is, I'll tell you a little this self-indulgent anecdote. I was on a vacation in March, this past March, in New Zealand, and with some dear friends. It was, you know, part half golf, of course, but half sightseeing. And it was during the NCAA tournament, basketball tournament. And my phone all of a sudden just, you know, I don't even know what time it was back in the States, but it was early morning in New Zealand. And my phone started buzzing. But did you hear what Charles Barkley just said about you on the NCAA tournament? So they were talking about Greg Gumbel, you know, who had done the NCAA tournament for a long time and who had passed away, who was, you know, a colleague of mine at CBS. And they're talking about what a wonderful guy he was and what a talented guy he was. And they were all, everybody on the panel, Ernie Johnson and the others, offered their thoughts and touching stories. And it got to Charles, and he said, well, one of the things I appreciated most about him is he could do any sport. He said, and there's very few guys who can do that. And he mentioned me, and he mentioned Kevin Harlan and Brian Anderson. And he said, and the other thing about all those guys is they're really nice people. He said, they're not, and I'm going to be emotional about that too, but because that's the most important thing to me. He said, they're not going to give you a chance to do all these things if people don't want to be around you and don't want to work with you. So I hadn't really thought of that. I hope that it's true. I mean, I think if you're nice, you probably got a better chance. You know, if you are a jerk over time, people are probably going to say, you know, all things being equal, maybe we'll hire that guy instead. So, you know, I try to treat the people I work with well. I wasn't successful at that when I first started out. When you're young and feeling the pressure of proving you belong, especially when you have a famous father, you know, you think everything is the most important thing. And, oh, my God, I stumbled over a sentence. And why is that graphic spelled wrong? And the audio stinks or whatever, you know, and you you get upset about it. And then as you go along, you realize, in part, it's just, I think, being deeper in your faith, but you realize that it's really not that important, those things I just listed. So, and then hopefully you're just good at your job, right? I think that's part of it. You know, people might like you, but if they don't think you're good at your job, they're not going to give you the opportunity. So I think it's the way you interact with people. And most important thing is how well you do your job. But, you know, I think how you interact with people, how well prepared are you, you know, those sorts of things are most important. But I think I've been at ESPN now for like 32 years. I had that 4-year hiatus at the end of the 90s when I was only at CBS, and then I went back to ESPN. So it's been something like 32 years over about a 35 or 36 year span.
And same thing with them.
We weren't even a thought in your parents. your parents probably didn't even know each other back then.
And even at ESPN, you've been able to still have that versatility. But in 2021, when ESPN was gaining the rights to the NHL, did that require foresight on your end too, to know that that was going to be in the pipeline? And then how were you able to go about it and make it apparent that, hey, this is a job that I really want? I want to be the lead voice for your coverage for years to come.
Yeah. I had heard mumblings that we wanted to get back in the NHL. But I didn't really know that the rights negotiations were going on when they were and that we were going to wind up with it. You know, I think we were out of it for about 17 years. I did the hockey in the NHL when we had it, but I wasn't the lead person. You know, we had Gary Thorne back then, who was great. And so I heard, you know, I was walking down the street one day and got a message, oh, we got the NHL. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. So, you know, I was 60 at the time, and I thought, you know what? I've got one more kind of big gig like this in me, I think. So I just texted Jimmy Pitaro, who runs, you know, I don't know what his title is, but he's the number one person at ESPN. Might be the next chairman of the Disney Corporation, Disney companies, if from what you're reading here, and he'd be a great choice. And I'm not just saying that because he's my boss. But anyway, so I just, you know, I'm just going to text Jimmy. So I texted him. Said, first of all, congratulations. It's a great thing for ESPN. I think it's great for the NHL. Both of which have turned out to be true. You know, the ratings have been better than they were in the past. The popularity of hockey has taken off, record attendance, and mentioned the Four Nations face-off. And I said, I'd really like to be the lead play-by-play person. You know, I did it when we had it before. And a lot of people told me they think hockey's my best sport because I didn't know if he ever knew that I did hockey, right? So he said, oh, that's great to know. This is not just going to be my decision. Norby Williamson is going to be involved, and Mike McQuaid and some other people, Mark Gross. And so he said, but I'm going to let them know that we chatted. So it was the same thing that I talked about with the Red Sox. It felt like it was forever. It was probably 3 months before they decided. And they called me and said, yeah, you're going to be the guy. So I hadn't really, you asked earlier about reflecting, and I hadn't really thought about it. And then my sister Erin said to me, do you realize you did the World Series when you were 30, and you were the youngest person ever to do it on national TV at that time, Joe Buck subsequently broke the record not long thereafter. And now you're going to do Stanley Cup final when you're 60. And there was all this stuff in between. And I thought, no, I hadn't really thought about that, but that's really cool, right? That Because when you do the World Series when you're 30, you think, I'm going to do this forever, right? And then CBS loses the rights, and you're going to do it for 2 years, and that's it. Whereas Joe Buck was at Fox for all those years, and they kept it, and he did, I think, 24 World Series, deservedly so. He's awesome as a person and as a broadcaster. He's become one of my really close friends in this business, and love the guy. He's just a great person and a great broadcaster. But, so I just decided when I heard we had the NHL, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to write to Jimmy Pitaro. I didn't have an agent at the time, so I kind of had to do it myself. I won't subsequently hired an agent because I didn't want to have to call other people and say, I should really be the guy. I mean, so, let the agent tell people how wonderful you are rather than do it yourself. It's a little off-putting.
I know that you're running short on time, so I'll clump in.
Oh, that's okay. I always have time for you.
Well, thank you for that. But how have you been able to deal in, again, this age of social media and criticism and so much of the negativity that goes in with that? How have you been able
to do social media?
Well, that part certainly helps.
Yeah, but I don't. I really don't. I mean, I've never had a Twitter account. I've never had Instagram. As Bill Belichick would say, my face or whatever, your face. You know, I've never had any of those. You're aware of it. I mean, sometimes people will screenshot you something, or sometimes that gets, you know, in a Google alert, like your name's mentioned, and then now it's online and it comes to my email. So, you know, sometimes you're aware of it. But when I was doing Monday Night Football, I told my sister, who does do it because she has a big job at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York in public affairs, and it's part of her job. She has this with me. I said, unless somebody, you know, says something really that I need to be aware of, I don't care, you know. So, I try to pay as little attention to it as I possibly can. And I generally succeed because, as I said, I don't do social media. And I'm fine not knowing. You know, I really, sometimes, you know, my sister used to say the people who like you have 400,000 followers and the people who hate you have 7. So, you know, it's like, I'll take that trade off.
It is. It's a good trade off. And last quick one, what keeps you motivated and going with your career at this point in time?
I think the fact, Griffin, that I still love it. You know, it has not ever gotten to the point where, oh gosh, I really don't want to get on the plane and go do that game. You know, or I don't want to do the preparation. You know, I'm sitting here as we talk with my charts. I'm about to jump on a conference call in 10 minutes with one of the teams for our football game this week. So I enjoy every aspect of it. You know, the preparation is time consuming, but I like learning about the players and, you know, hopefully once or twice in every game, there's a really good human interest story that touches people. You know, our first game of the football season this year was Miami Notre Dame. CJ Carr was the quarterback for Notre Dame, making his debut. Grandson of the legendary Lloyd Carr. He was the Michigan coach. You know, how does a guy's grandfather was the legendary Hall of Fame coach at Michigan go to Notre Dame? So you get into that. And then, you know, we told the story during the game. He lost his younger brother when CJ was 5. His brother Chad was 10. His brother Chad was 5 to a brain cancer. And the mom, Tammy's been a driving force behind this Chad Strong Foundation that they started. And they've raised millions and millions of dollars for research and for treatments, and which is a really noble thing to do when, you know, you can't bring your child back. They want to make sure other people don't go through the same thing. So we told that story. And then, you know, he throws a touchdown pass and they show the mom. And I got choked. I generally don't care who wins. We're not supposed to. But you had to feel good for her in that moment, right? So you try to find the stories like that and tell them at the right time to make people who may otherwise not really care take an interest in the people that they're watching.
Yeah, it was. That's a great microcosm of you as a broadcaster and relating the human interest part to the actual game. Well, Sean, thank you very much.
There's a lot of stories every week. I mean, they're not all tragedies, right? I mean, but and they're a lot of them are very uplifting stories. But you know, like we did Oklahoma last week, The offensive coordinator, Ben Arbuckle, who's 30 and has become like a rising star in coaching, he grew up about 3 hours away from Norman, Oklahoma. He's in high school. He starts dating this girl who's a huge Oklahoma fan. They had their first date at an Oklahoma football game when he was 16 years old. And he's got the pictures of them sitting like in the last row of the end zone, you know. So I love stuff like that. And it's one of the reasons I enjoy college football more than the NFL as a broadcaster and really as a fan. Because in the NFL, there's really not time for that. You know, you're not sitting there talking about Tom Brady has an amazing stamp collection. You know, college football is the right place for me.
It certainly is. Well, good luck on the call this weekend. LSU Ole Miss, going to be a good one.
Well, you did a fantastic job. I'm not surprised. We're talking about preparation. You're very well prepared. And I hope you'll have me back again because usually I'm so long-winded. I'm sure you had other questions that we didn't get to due to time.
File them away.
I have to move ahead to further action, as we say, this conference call. But good luck with this. And I'm looking forward to watching your career because you're a rising star in our business. And I admire what a good person you are, too.
That's going to put a wrap on episode 2. Thank you for listening to my conversation with Sean McDonough. And in the future, we're certainly going to have him back because he's told me some incredible stories that just due to time constraints and this being his busiest point in probably the entire year with not just college football, but the NHL about to start here shortly. And then we'll sprinkle in some MLB playoff baseball in there as well. So we'll have him on in the future. You'll hear more about his incredible insight. I hope that you enjoyed this episode and watch out for who we're going to have here in episode 3. We'll see you next time.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.